With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Escaping Cerberus, the podcast where we rewatch, reminisce and review everything Doctor Who from 2005 to present. My name is Rich and I'm joined by the one person who always brings a banana to a party. It's Amy.
I don't even like bananas, to be honest with you.
Well, then that's why you're crap at parties, Amy.
Hey,
it's why when it's my birthday I don't invite you.
Hey, my birthday's the day before yours. If anything, I don't invite you.
Fine, then I won't bring a banana to your party, okay. And you won't bring one to mine, and okay. We'll all be happy, won't
okay.
we?
That's
yeah.
fine. That's
we're going to start this episode off with a domestic.
About bananas.
About bananas that neither of us like. I don't even like, I don't think I like anything banana related.
Nah, anything that's like banana flavoured or banana scented can get in the bin.
I feel like there was a period of time where I enjoyed like banana milkshakes, and now I get a whiff of banana whenever you bake banana stuff, and I'm like, ugh!
Yeah, just, nah.
No thank you.
I haven't baked bananas in a while, thank God.
First segue of the podcast, I've not even introduced the episode. Welcome to episode 4 of series 2. It is time for The Girl in the Fireplace, aired on the 6th of May, 2006, so we had just turned 11, and written by Stephen Moffat, which for some reason, I always forget that this was written by Stephen Moffat. I think we talked about Stephen Moffat back in the Empty Child Doctor Dances episodes last series, and there were people in the comments just like, you know, you are aware he wrote Girl in the Fireplace as well, it wasn't just Empty Child and Blink, and it's like, yeah.
Well, he had a good track run during T. Davies era, let's just say that. Is that what you call it? A good track record?
Track record. You were close.
Track record.
He had a good run or a good track record.
That's the one.
Not both. But he did, he really, really did. So as I've said a million times, and I'm sure I'll mention a million times again, the idea of him taking over as showrunner was always so exciting because his stuff was so good. Mm-hmm. And then you give him the keys to the entire series and it all just kind of falls apart a bit.
Yeah, so, it's always
not,
the way
not
I feel
entirely,
kind of like.
But you assume that someone who can craft such phenomenal one or two part stories, that giving them a series, it's like, oh, this could go down really well. But
yeah, but alas, writing one story compared to writing three or four
series. Oh yeah, it's a whole different kettle of fish.
Different.
But you know, still, there was that hope that he would have like nailed it. Like he
he was still better than Chibnall.
It's true. We'll see if Chibbers can keep his Dalek track record up come Christmas-ish. We've had our reveal by the time of recording that Captain Jack is coming back for Revolution
Captain
of the Daleks.
Jack.
But we don't know whether it's still being aired at Christmas yet. Like a few people tweeted me this as well, and I did see it on the BBC website that they were talking about. The BBC are talking about their Christmas schedule at the moment, and they mentioned Doctor Who, but they don't say when it's being aired.
It's because last time it was a New Year special.
Well, even with the press release of with John Barrowman coming back, they still just say holiday special. and mm-hmm. festive season. They don't say when it's going to be airing.
Which means it will probably be annoyingly either New Year's or smack bang in the middle between Christmas and New Year.
They just randomly air it. It's on the 28th. It's like, wow.
Cash.
What way to relegate Doctor Who? I don't know.
Genius.
I want it to be Christmas Day because I miss going home and forcing my family to watch Doctor Who. I mean, they won't. They will just leave me to it. My mum and dad will be asleep on the sofa. My siblings will just leave and I'll just sit on the like in the middle of the floor, like right in front of the TV, eyes wide, ready to watch.
The only good thing about Doctor Who not being on Christmas Day last year was the fact that I didn't have to listen to my dad snoring over the top of it. Because he usually comes over on Christmas Day, eats with us, and then while we're all playing games and doing stuff, he'll fall asleep. And then whatever we're trying to watch on telly that evening is just drowned out by his snoring. Which I really hope he doesn't listen to this, because...
I don't think he will. Anyway, let's talk about the girl in the fireplace. So
yes.
Mickey has boarded the TARDIS after the end of school reunion, and he is now out on his first adventure. So this does take place directly after mm-hmm. the events of school reunion, because when they clamber out of the TARDIS onto the spaceship in the 51st century, Mickey says, "Oh, it's a spaceship! I got a spaceship on my first go." So, you know, heavily implying that this was
isn't
his
she
first
wearing
trip.
The same? Aren't they wearing the same clothes as well? I'm pretty sure Rose is wearing the same T-shirt.
No,
is she not?
I don't think so.
Well, yeah, but why would? Why would Mickey have changed clothes, though? Because he wouldn't have had anything to change it unless they decided to go from reunion home to pack a bag and then join the TARDIS.
That's the thing, like, they dematerialise at the end of school reunion, and obviously then K-9's revealed behind the TARDIS, but they could have just gone back to the powerless state for Mickey to go grab his bag of stuff and kiss goodbye to his mam.
I don't know why, I just feel like I remember Rose wearing the same T-shirt at the end of school reunion when
I think she's still wearing blue, but I'm gonna have to check this now.
Yeah,
now
that you've, I don't know. I'm probably wrong, but
I don't think she's wearing the same T-shirt.
I mean, you wouldn't have thought so.
No, she. Oh, you say that. No, she is wearing a blue T-shirt.
Right.
But it's not the same blue T-shirt, at least not
so they
that I
must
can
have
see.
Just hopped quick back home to pack a bag and then...
Must have been. I mean, Rose would have already had clothes on the TARDIS anyway, but yeah, she's still wearing just a normal blue T-shirt and her hair is... Because she's got that hair sort of like crimped almost, or just like sort of not
wavy.
Curled. It's wavy, that's the word.
Wavy.
I don't know about hair. so, you know, I just find it funny to think that Rose sits on the TARDIS and, like, does her hair.
I know.
In between trips. Like, it's like, Doctor,
I mean,
do any straighteners, perchance?
Got any
Or
crimpers?
Does Rose bring them with her? Yeah.
She probably brought them with her. I mean, did you see the bag she packed?
Down the stairs, past the bins, there's the TARDIS salon is
in
right
the beauty
there.
Room.
Yeah, it's where I keep my wigs, the Doctor says, as he removes his hair. Actually, I mean, he does that, technically, doesn't he? In series 7. But anyway.
What?
You'll know what I'm talking about when we get to it. Time of
okay.
the Doctor.
Okay.
We end up in the 51st century and we find windows leading back to 18th century France.
1727.
1727. We're gonna see
I was just about
Lynn
to do that.
musical of this. And the Doctor becomes this imaginary friend to Renette, better known as Madame de Pompadour.
I have a question. Was Madame de Pompadour a real person?
Yes.
Right.
The mistress of King
Louis.
Which is... It's just kind of hilarious, the idea that the king of France can just be like, here's my wife, here's the queen.
Here's my mistress.
Here's the side bay. And the thing is, like, I'm just looking now, she was the chief mistress. So
we hear multiple.
Were there multiple ones?
Probably.
So, yeah, interesting. And obviously, even though Renette sees the Doctor twice when she is young,
mm-hmm.
both times when, I think she said she was 7 years old.
Yeah.
Once just through the fireplace, and then the second time when the clockwork droid's under her bed. In those many years, I mean, how many years is it implied? Between,
well, she's 20.
She was 23, so assumedly
when he checks her age,
16 years. But does he see her before then? Yes, he does. He snogs her, and
then comes
there's the moment
back.
When she's like, flanked by the clockwork droids, and they take it out and stuff, and then he asks her age. So over that time,
doesn't he check her in the fireplace? Not the fireplace, in the garden, before he finds out her age.
Yes, but he
doesn't
speak to her.
No, but that must have been extra time.
Sees her in the garden, comes back through after defeating the clockwork droid, where she's grown up, mm-hmm. and kisses him. So obviously between those two times, she's developed feelings for him.
Somehow. After
weirdly.
Only meeting him really once.
I mean, I don't want to go down the rabbit hole again of what happens if David Tennant ends up in your bedroom, but
I mean
let's just move on before we annoy the comment section. Yeah. It's quite strange, and in fact, do you know what, it's gonna kind of lead to one of the questions from M. Louise from YouTube. And they ask, I'm wondering what you think about the romance between Renette and the Doctor. I've always felt the relationship between them was slightly forced, and it's always seemed like his treatment of Rose is very out of place, considering how protective both the Ninth and Tenth Doctor of her.
Mm.
But I do love the episode, though. And M raises a very good point. Because, yeah. It seems kind of strange. It'd be... I feel like when the Doctor says... When she kisses him and that bloke comes in and he has like one line, which is, who the hell are you? And he realizes he's snogged Madame de Pompadour, and he's like, oh my God, it's her. It's like, this person, yeah, she did this, she's a great dancer, you know, fantastic gardener.
Yeah.
Just proper cockney for that.
He does.
He seems really like excited by that fact, and yet he doesn't seem like much of a fan. Like, imagine, think of how the Ninth Doctor saw Charles Dickens and how much he, like, freaks out because he's so excited to meet Charles Dickens. If he'd have had that same response with Madame de Pompadour, maybe that justification of the Doctor almost falling for her as well, because he kind of does, maybe that would have been a bit more justified. But it more feels like he sees a window to some action and he just jumps on it.
I don't know. I don't know that I would agree with that necessarily. I think... the kiss comes out of nowhere, like, 100%, because literally, he met her when she was 7, then again when she was 7, and then all of a sudden, the next time they meet, she's snogging his face off. And I think she must maybe only be about, maybe 18 there, or something like that, we can assume. But yeah, it does come very, very out of nowhere. And the thing is like... he starts kind of like, oh, get away from me. And then you see, right towards the end of their kiss, he's like, well, do you know what, might as well have a bit of
this. He kind of reciprocates it as a close-up, and you see him, like, happily go along with it.
He stops, like, kind of trying to get away from her, and he sort of goes, this is quite nice, actually, and, like, starts lowering his hand to her waist, as you sort of subtly see it, and then she runs off. So I don't know whether necessarily he, like, sees a window to some action, because realistically, I don't think he's there to sort of be like, hey, you could probably get a bit of a bang in here, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
He's just trying to work out what's going on, and the fact that she snogged him, maybe, was kind of the catalyst for him being like, do you know what? She was this. She was a lovely gardener. She was a dancer. She was this. She was this. And
like,
it's
I do
kinda
admire
like,
her.
Yeah, he's like admiring her achievements. And then he's like, do you know what? She just snogged me. So might as well jump on that bandwagon.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably more so what it is.
And
that's kind of more
what
I was implying, not the idea of, oh, the Doctor can get a free shag. There is that potential connection there. Because in the same way we've talked about with Rose before, about there's this person that he feels that he can be comfortable with, he can open up to, and therefore that those kind of feelings will be there.
And the thing is, obviously, when they do like that that kind of thoughts exchange section in the middle where, like, he's reading her mind, but she also reads his, I feel like he's kind of put off by that. But then at the same time, like, she's so clever that she doesn't, like, shy away from anything. She just kind of adapts into it. Like, when Rose is explaining to her right at the end, like, there's a vessel, and she summarizes it in far more, like, you know, concisely and sort of...
oh, yeah, she's, like, incredibly clever.
So I feel like that also draws the Doctor to her. But his treatment of Rose, I feel, is... yeah, it's a bit odd in this one, because Rose and Mickey in this episode don't really have a purpose other than to be captured. And it's not unfortunate, because it doesn't detract from the episode. Obviously, you need that back and forth between the ship, them kind of piecing together what's going on, and, like, the Doctor going through to, like, watch Renette's life and stuff. But I think because of the fact that he's so focused on Renette and the fact that this woman has sort of, like, suddenly come into his life and he doesn't know what's going on, he's almost more intrigued by her situation and the fact that she keeps, like, why she keeps getting older when he can literally just appear for, like, 10 seconds and then all of a sudden she's, like, you know, 4-5 years older. So I don't know about that one. It's a bit difficult. Like, I feel like I gel with the connection. Like, I feel like the connection works because she is exactly the sort of person he would connect with on a sort of base level of, like, intelligence, of, like, you know, she's attractive, she doesn't shy away from him, she's always, like, sort of wanting to see him. And I feel like some people you just kind of get that connection with. And yeah, he has that with Rose, but I feel like, you know, the reason that the Rose kind of gets put on the back foot in this episode is, A, for the audience's benefit, because for the audience to sort of see that emotional impact from Rose's point of view, obviously the Doctor doesn't see that. So for the audience's benefit, the fact that he sacrifices his normal life for her, for Madame de Pompadour, is something that literally the audience only really get to see the ramifications of that, because as soon as the Doctor comes back, Rose is all, oh my god, you're back, and that's it, really, like, you know. But it does make you wonder why he would, I mean, he keeps his promises, obviously he's the Doctor, isn't he, but it does kind of make you wonder why he would abandon Rose for the sake of a woman that realistically he's only known for a couple of hours
altogether. It's quite strange. I can understand why, like, M sees it as being forced, and the truth of Rose feels out of place. Obviously, with Mickey being there, as you said, they serve not really masses of purpose. Like, this could have probably quite easily been a Doctor or a companion light episode, like Midnight.
Mm-hmm.
Could have easily been like that. But with Mickey there, it kind of disables the Doctor to really have those kind of feelings. Like, if you were being, like, really pally, I say pally, like, you were much more comfortable with someone that you liked, but they were with somebody else, and when their partner is actually there, you can't act in that same way.
Because that's, you're worried it will upset the partner.
Because it's, like, either the person you're wanting to be friend, like, closer to would either read that as, can you stop, like, coming on to me while my partner's here, or yeah, the partner might kick off in retaliation.
Mickey is the partner.
But interestingly, Mickey isn't, now that he's out there with the Doctor and Rose, he doesn't seem territorial, and nor does the Doctor. They both seem to sort of, Mickey is, admittedly, it's more in the moment. Like, he's on a big spaceship, you know, he's crapped himself at the stars. He says they look really realistic. It's like, way to point out the iffy CGI, Mickey. You know, he's there with the fire extinguisher. He's doing, like, commando rolls around the ship. Like, he's on cloud nine.
Oh,
like,
he's loving it.
In reality, Rose is not on his wavelength. And the Doctor sort of shies away from them both. You know, I think he feels like he is now the third wheel. And rather than getting himself in the middle of it, he only really gets in between them when he has to. When it's like, right, here's a time to act clever. Here's a time to move the plot forward. Here's a time to save them from the clockwork droids. Otherwise, he just sort of keeps himself to himself. He'll go wander around with Arthur.
Yeah.
Or go find a mirror, Arthur, and go for a snog. So
yeah, it's an interesting point bringing up Mickey, because I think it definitely changes the dynamic of the traveling group. Because, I mean, obviously, like, you know, if you ever sort of had a crush on somebody who you think has a crush on you back, but for some reason is maybe unavailable, but, like, you're not entirely sure, it's a very different situation when you're alone together to how it is when you're around other people.
Especially when the other person is potentially the
The other half. And I feel like Mickey sort of being involved, because Rose was all like, I don't, like, you know, she didn't really want him to come. And then at the end of the last episode, and then as soon as this episode comes in, she's like, oh my god, look, let's show you around the ship, let's do this, let's, and she suddenly changed her tune. Like, she doesn't seem to be that upset that Mickey's there anymore, and maybe the Doctor was kind of like, maybe we shouldn't have said he could come, and so he kind of like skips off. And
I'd assume that the reason why she was so concerned, obviously, as we said last time, was the fact that she just had this, she had this own idea as to how things would pan out between the three of them. And in reality, things seem pretty, they seem civil on all sides. Like, I think it was Matthew said, yeah, what the Doctor's saying, what does revolution, what is pre-revolutionary France doing on a spaceship? Mickey says, oh, what's a horse doing on a spaceship? And the Doctor says, what's pre-revolutionary France doing on a spaceship? Mickey gets some perspective. Matthew asks whether that's, like, the Doctor taking the piss out of Mickey, or just stating the sort of bigger question. And it's like, the 10th Doctor doesn't really feel that way towards Mickey.
No, he doesn't. The same way Nine did, where he was like, Mickey the idiot. Whereas, because the 9th Doctor, you could almost be mistaken for almost being more of a dad figure to Rose, where he was like very protective of the fact that this was Rose's boyfriend and that's not okay because I'm like almost like her dad and I don't appreciate my daughter's boyfriend's kind of like stereotypical father of the bride role. Whereas Tennant, obviously being younger, being more like on her wavelength and on like kind of like, you know, that age gap being smaller, doesn't see Mickey
visually
as
smaller.
Yeah, well, not I know what you mean. Technically, he's older, but like, you know what I mean. From Rose's perspective, anyway, it doesn't. He's coming across more now as a love interest than he was a father figure. Like before, she might have loved him in the same way you love your sister or your friends or like whatever. Whereas now she's like, damn, he's hot. I could get me some of that. And is loving him now in a very romantic way. She might have loved Eccleston in a romantic way, but obviously it was slightly different. And so, yeah, I don't feel like Tennant's Doctor really takes the piss out of Mickey in the same way that Nine did. I feel like he very much is like, I think as without being kind of like breaking the fourth wall and all that lot, I don't really feel like he was saying it for the sake of anything except a joke. And like you know, like Moffat wrote a joke in that Mickey just happened to be the butt of. But I think it was more the case that like Mickey, obviously Mickey's still learning. He's still like, this is his first trip out. And so it wouldn't be Rose asking that question. Like if you were going to put the joke in, it almost had to be Mickey asking the question. And so I feel like the Doctor's reasoning of saying like, what's 18th century France doing on a spaceship? Get some perspective. Is not as a way of sort of putting Mickey down or being like, come on, Mickey, the idiot. Like, he's just kind of being like, come on, Mickey. Like if you're going to be part of the team, at least ask the right questions. Like he's trying to bring him in and say like when he's saying get some perspective, it's kind of like he wants him to be involved and he wants him to be part of the group almost, I feel, rather than him like trying to estrange him and like take the mickey out of him a bit.
Take the mickey. Hey! There you go. So yeah, the dynamic is it's a strange like normality to it after no time, well barely any time at all between the end of school reunion, you know, Rose's reaction to now. So yeah, but like going back to sort of the relationship side, Sophia Miles plays Madame de Pompadour, who she's very pretty. The only real thing that I can think of that I know her from otherwise is she played Lady Penelope in the 2004 Thunderbirds live action film.
No way! I knew I recognised her from that the one with Vanessa Hudgens?
Yep.
Damn.
Played Tintin. Wait, I'm not gonna lie, I love that film.
It wasn't a bad film.
It is a bad film, but it's also like me and my siblings watched the hell out of
it's guilty pleasure, isn't it?
It's a big guilty pleasure
it's
film.
A plus, whole block of cheese.
Plus Busted did the song for it.
I mean,
so which is an absolute bop.
It's a tune. Thunderbirds Are Go.
Yeah. So yeah, she plays Lady Penelope in that, and that was really the only other thing that I knew her.
Yeah.
From.
Because was that around? That was a couple of years before this, wasn't it?
It was 2004, and obviously this would have been recorded in 2005.
Right. So not long after.
2006. So not long after. No. Because she was only. She would have only been 25 when she filmed that.
Oh wow! So when they say she's 23, not far off.
Actually, not wrong. She's very mature looking for her age.
Damn, yeah. Because if you put her next to us, right?
Obviously, she was the same age as us when
she was 25 and died 2005. I'm 25 now. I'm not being funny, but if you put the two of us next to each other at the same age, nah.
You kind of assume that she was older.
No way, yeah. I look 25.
but her and David Tennant were a thing for 2 years.
Mm.
Assumedly, I'm going to sort of assume that they met. They began dating after filming Doctor Who.
I mean, you snog someone like that. I wonder how many times they had to snog on set to get
Tennant
the kiss right.
met his current wife on the set of Doctor Who as well, in the Doctor's
played
daughter.
Played his daughter,
who is also the daughter of the fifth Doctor, Peter Davison. So it's all wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey.
But I mean, even if you date David Tennant for 2 years, I would put that on my CV for the rest of my life.
And
I dated David Tennant from the years of 2005 to 2007.
The weekly thirst.
Hey,
oh my God. I'm just
blaming.
Just because I've got her Wikipedia page open, it turns out that from 2004 to 2005, she was in a relationship with Charles Dance.
Who's that?
As in the guy, he played Lord Mountbatten in The Crown, and he was in Game of Thrones.
Damn!
Yeah.
What's the age gap there?
Pretty substantial. I'm good. I mean, if that aired 14 years ago, he'd have been 60.
No way.
And she'd have been 24.
Oh.
Hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
At least
David Tennant
was closer to her age.
A little bit, but yeah. moving on. Something about Moffat's episodes that I wanted to bring up. There's a couple of things about Moffat's stuff. Obviously, one thing Moffat does is he takes a fear that's sort of a general overall fear, or something usually necessarily not feared, and turns into something scary. So you've got gas masks in the Empty Child and Doctor Dances. Obviously, gas masks are inherently fearful because people may associate them with the Blitz. But for me, I just
They're
associated
just a
gas
bit
masks.
Creepy looking.
Yeah, I just associated gas masks with The Empty Child. I remember going to, it must have been the Imperial War Museum in London, and I saw gas masks hanging up on a wall, and I was just like, nope, I'm done.
Multiple
I am,
school trips.
I am terrified of gas masks. I don't like this. Please leave me alone. Obviously, you have statues in Blink. You have a pretty certain.
Which, thanks very much, Moffat. I can never walk near statues again now.
Yeah. You have Moffat did write just confirm me before I say something really stupid. He did write Silence in the Library and Forest of the Dead as well.
Oh, did he?
I have to double check this.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Or did he?
Or was that a T. Davies?
That is a Russell T. Davies thing. I'm just checking his. Can I have some right? Oh, here you go. Writing credits. That's what I was looking for. He did write Silence in the Library for
us. So Shadows as well.
So Shadows, yeah.
Fantastic.
He takes little things and makes them scary. And the way that he incorporates that in The Girl in the Fireplace, which I didn't really sort of think about, obviously now that we're watching this and doing a bit more analytical viewing, we're still kind of watching it very casually. We're not taking notes. We've mentioned specific things maybe once or twice to be like, if I say that to you, I'll probably remember it to talk about in the podcast later. When the clockwork droid is under her bed, he says like, you know, don't go near the edges, stay in the middle. And obviously that's just playing up on that fear in the middle of the night that you've got your hand or your leg hanging off the side of the bed. You instinctively pull it back onto the bed under the duvet, maybe even wrap the duvet underneath your leg,
because
your
arm. All know the monsters under the bed can't get through duvets.
Monsters under the bed can't get you if you're any of your appendages aren't hanging off the edge of the bed. And I didn't really notice that on that watch through. Like, if they, he could have really leant on it and made it so they all of the gateways somehow came out from under.
See, what
the bed.
I want to know, right, is, and I right. said this to you when we were watching it, was he goes to Renette, stay in the middle of the bed, don't put your hands and feet over the edge, blah blah blah. And then he looks under the bed, right? Now, obviously, thank you very much, Moffat, we needed a jump scare. However, my question is, you go under a little girl's bed in the middle of a big 18th century bedroom. She's not exactly going to have storage boxes. She's not going to have socks shoved under there.
She's not going to have her old PlayStation
so
in the bed, is she?
Why in the hell does he look under the bed, sees a giant French 18th century faced person, as far as he's concerned, and doesn't do anything until the thing whacks the sonic screwdriver out of his hand? Because, yes, we needed the jump scare really badly, didn't we? He's literally there, like, I don't
see
anything.
You are right,
anything.
He is, like, staring straight
anything.
At
and it. And then it goes whack, and then all of a sudden he's like, I'm going to something there. Like, really? Come on. And then he stands up, and this he just sees, like, the shoes, and then he looks up, and there's a thing. It's like, well, I mean, why are you shocked? You just saw it under the bed. We could all see the wig. You could see the wig. I don't get it. Sorry, but
are you okay there? Just, rant over.
Yeah, just
I mean, no, you're right. Like, the way that his arm, the way that its arm is, like, angled, you'd assume that he'd look under, and the mask is, like, staring the doctor straight in the face. Obviously, based on, obviously, they can't really shoot in super darkness.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, but maybe it's implied that the lighting conditions in that room are a lot darker than we perceive them.
Well, you would hope, because, I mean, he turns the candle on, doesn't he, with his sonic screwdriver.
Turns the fireplace.
No, the candle.
No,
when he's next to the bed, and he goes, look, it's just me, it's the guy from the fireplace.
Yeah, he turns the fireplace on.
He points the sonic screwdriver at the candle and turns the candle on.
Maybe it turns the candles on as well, but he turns the fireplace on.
But it was just, like, how can you turn candles on with a sonic screwdriver?
I mean, how can Dumbledore do it with his own hand? So,
well, Dumbledore's a wizard. The Doctor isn't
a
wizard.
Yeah, well, so is the Doctor. Checkmate.
Yeah, no, what? No, he's not.
Yeah. I want to see the Doctor go back to the wizard. No, let's not talk about that.
Okay, never mind.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yes. Yeah. So
that was one of Moffat's little sort of recurring things that he likes to play up on with those fears. And the other thing that, again, I'd never really noticed until now.
Mm.
Obviously, with this romance between the Doctor and Madame de Pompadour, there is a lot of, you know, the eyes that Nala does in The Lion King.
The sex eyes.
Simba, will you a Hakuna Matatas? Like, there is very much that look from her a lot. And, you know, she's, like, kissing him, and when... Yeah. Can you every goddamn week? You're gonna get that noise. When the Doctor's reading her mind, which is another thing, like the Doctor's psychic powers that we only really get to see with Tennant. Like, I love that.
Yeah, because Matt Smith just bangs his head into
scans
people.
It, yeah, he bangs his head, and usually uses his sonic screwdriver instead. When they're doing the sort of mind reading thing, and the Doctor says, like, oh, if there's anything you don't want to see, imagine a door and close it. And the first thing he does is go, oh. And honestly, my first thought is she is literally showing him, this is how I look naked, by the way. It, like, 100%.
Oh, duh. I mean, like, the look on her face, she looks up at him and she almost does the lip bite of, like,
She's got the Hakuna eyes. She's doing the Hakuna eyes. Even the Doctor's like, oh. Like, similar to the kiss, at first he's like, oh, God, and then goes, actually, do you know what? Go for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it comes to the point when Rose and Mickey are captured by the droids, again, it's the only real substantial thing they do, apart from the scene when Rose comes and tells Madame de Pompadour they'll be here in 5 years, which could have easily been the Doctor.
I don't understand.
It's very poorly explained when she says, why can't he be here to promise this himself? She just sort of brushes past it.
It's the way it's got to be. Why?
It's like, this is obviously just,
let's give Rose something to do.
It's in the same way that it's like, quick, give Ryan something obvious to point out in series 12 and 13 to make it so
what
he's
is
got...
That?
Like, just, yeah, we need to give him a line. Cool, let's do that. So in reality, for like Rose and for Mickey's first adventure, he's barely in it. For mm-hmm. Rose's first big adventure with Mickey, they're barely in it. Like, it's a shame.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
But when it gets to that point when she says, you know, come and dance with me,
yeah,
and he's like, I just can't, it's set events, come and dance.
And
it's like, think about the fact that in The Empty Child, or more so The Doctor Dances, dancing is a big old metaphor for shagging.
I mean,
so
you said that downstairs, you were like, oh, is this, do we think this is a Moffat's metaphor for shagging? And I was like,
because he's used it before.
Maybe. However, he then comes in with a tie wrapped around his head, sunglasses on.
I am not disputing that there was some dancing.
He went to a party and danced.
You go out to the club with your best bitch in your best frock.
I mean,
and you do some dancing, and then you leave the club. You go pick up a box of fried chicken.
You
go home. And you do some more dancing.
If you don't pick up a box of fried chicken on the way home from the club, did you even go out?
Did you even dance, bro?
Or, like, I'll accept a kebab or pizza as well. Like, but you've got to have some sort of food. Or Mackey's.
Gotta have
some... Yeah,
I've just made you a curry. I have just made you a curry.
But it's the thought of having food at, like, 4 o'clock in the morning when you're absolutely rat-assed and you're just, like, stuffing chicken nuggets in your face because they're the best
thing
ever.
It was the worst thing about, like, when we were at uni, it was, like, every time we go out, we go to Express Diner in Coventry.
Or Blue Rooster it ended up being.
Or Blue Rooster.
In later years. If you're from Coventry, let us know.
Blue Rooster on Butts, next to the Aardvark, the pub I used to work in.
Butts is the road, by the way, in case that confuses anybody.
And then... The Express Diner on Far Gosford Street, didn't that close?
Yeah, it was replaced by something else.
But anyway, yeah, like you're out, you're pissed. You've had loads of, but your mouth tastes like booze, and you just think the only thing that's going to remedy this isn't a nice toothbrush and some toothpaste. It's a box of greasy fried chicken. That's what you need.
And fries.
And then I go home, go out in Horncastle with some friends. And I'm, like, pissed out of my mind. And it's, like, we're in the middle of, like, a tiny, like, tiny town in rural Lincolnshire.
Yep.
And there's nowhere to get fried chicken. I'm staying at a mate's house. So I can't go raid the freezer and make myself some food. So it's, like, you've got that taste of just wanting fried chicken and, you can't have it anyway.
And that's why Northampton is okay for a night out, because all the clubs are on the same street as Mackey's.
That's good to know. Anyway, the doctor goes and does some. Oh, the doctor does some dancing, and the Hakuna eyes and the let's go and dance. And then when the doctor saves Renette from the clockwork droids when she does turn 37, she says, you know, take my hand, and she leads him to the bedroom. And you have that shot of the camera moving to the left. You have them in the doorway. In the foreground, you've got the bed, and it's like, here's the bed, taking up a third of the frame. It's like, you gotta be, look, it's a bed. Bed, 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 bed. They're gonna start dancing. And then it's like, oh, by the way, there's the fireplace. That's actually what she meant. So it's like, even the cinematography, the script, the cinematography, the eyes of, oh my God, David Doomy.
Who doesn't?
All of that. All of that was, I admittedly,
exactly.
I planted that one. All of that was relevant. All of that was deliberate. Mm-hmm. And I love that. I love that.
It's the sort of thing that as a child, you kind of...
You don't notice.
Skip over because it's not relevant to the episode. But as a family show, you go, oh, damn, he just seen her titties in her mind.
But as I said, I you know, when we're having the discussion when we did the Doctor Dances, when Jack's on the railway track going and we see the second transformation sequence in Doctor Dances, and the Doctor and Rose just stood there talking about dancing.
Yeah.
And it was only really like that time we watched it, did it really click. It's like, he's talking about Jack going and shagging stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. Mm-hmm. Like, and I love that that's the thing. Like, I love the way that when things like this get away with adult humor, it's why I love things like Gravity Falls. It's why like Aardman films are really good, because A, they're just really well made, they're really well written, they're really well acted and just funny films, but also because they get away with some really like adult humor through it that just goes completely over the kids' heads.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know what you're listening for, you're gonna get a good pop out of it. So
yep.
You know, not only is it quite a moving story, when, you know,
I think it is,
the Doctor works out, the Doctor works out that the fireplace works, he goes back, and you know, he's so blinded by this idea that he could go with Renette. He, you know, if Rose has got Mickey, that's what I was saying. And
he could have Renette.
Know, not to sound shallow, but it's like, I've got some real hottie, like, clamoring
the
for a slice of this.
The mistress of France.
You just kind of like, is it going to be stupid of me to turn this down? Yes.
However, had he actually managed to get Renette out of the fireplace, how do you think Rose would have felt about that, man? Because I mean, she
clearly, that's something we don't explore.
It's not that she doesn't like her, but I think she's very offish with her when, like, I mean, when she goes to speak to her and is like, "The Doctor will be here in 5 years' time," she's very offish with her. You can tell, like, she just wants to get out of there and like go. And even though she has that moment of like, "Are you okay?" when they're on the spaceship and she can hear the screaming and stuff, that's more of like just like a kind of friendly, caring instinct. I really don't think that she's that keen on her, because despite the fact that obviously Mickey's there and they're trying to, like, you know, they're off doing their own thing and what have you, obviously Rose is still in love with, like, the Doctor, and he's off sort of fannying around with this other woman. And she's kind of like, "Oh, I guess am I just nothing now then? Okay, cool, great, thanks. They're fabulous, thank you very much." And, you know, that's her. So had he actually managed to get her out of the fireplace and brought her back, it would have been a very awkward flight.
Yeah, a little bit. But yeah, the Doctor's so caught up in this excitement, this person that he maybe perhaps feels like he could actually be with, whether whether he just sees this as a bit of a fun fling, or whether it's like this could somehow be something, I guess. I don't know. He gets so caught up in the like 2 minutes pack a bag, and it's like, you forget, Doctor, the events from, you know, for you probably a couple of hours ago, like, you disappear for 30 seconds from one of these time windows, you come back and time has jumped forward, and obviously he comes back and Madame de Pompadour has passed away.
Well, how old was she? She was 37 when they invaded, and then she was 43 when she died.
47, was it? She was 42.
42. So only 5 years have passed. So in 30 seconds of him going back to tell Mickey and Rose to get in the TARDIS, which might not have even been 30 seconds, it was probably literally maybe like 15, time has elapsed for 5 years.
Yeah,
which is
and she unfortunately passes away from, I want to see what disease it was.
It was just
an illness that.
Once again, and this is like, you know, a kind of a running joke with us now, but I felt more for the two of them and their relationship than I ever did for Binny. So,
yeah, she died of tuberculosis.
Oh man.
So
damn,
yeah, because we see the Doctor, you know, conveniently leaves the fireplace again 5 years later when the, you know, King...
Louis.
King... It is Louis. Mm-hmm. Is stood at the window seeing her hearse be taken away from Versailles. Mm-hmm. And she leaves him the letter. And you just see... He doesn't even speak.
Yeah.
Like, just...
That whole scene... He literally just comes in distraught. And says, is Renette here? And I think as soon as he says she'll be on her way to Paris, she'll be in Paris by 6. Isn't that when the Doctor doesn't talk then after that? Does he say anything after that?
I don't know.
I don't think he does.
I don't think so. I think she
I think
just
that whole
kind
scene
of,
is just in silence.
I think maybe that was the realisation, you know, that the mood of the room he could probably read as he walked in. You know, the idea that, you know, when he says, when King Louis says, like, you know,
she was
you've
right.
You've not, yeah, she's right, you haven't aged a day. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of like, oh, how long has it been?
Yeah.
And obviously he would have known, you know, he knows all this about Madame de Pompadour. He knows that she passed away at 42. Maybe this is one of the reasons why he's like so excited, because he's like, you've still got 5 years. Yeah. We can go and do this. But even more so, what I was thinking is, obviously, even though I didn't know what the disease was, because they don't say in the episode that it's tuberculosis.
They just say illness took her in the end.
Just says illness. What if, running through the Doctor's mind at this point, was the idea that if she were with him...
She wouldn't...
He could have saved her.
Maybe.
Because assumedly, like, I don't... Because, I mean, I'm not an expert on tuberculosis, but I'm assuming it's not a fatal illness in today's medicine. I'm assuming it's not.
I don't know. I can't say yes or no to that one. I'm not a doctor.
No, I'm trying to see if there's any, like...
Just Google, is tuberculosis fatal? But I don't know whether he would or not. Maybe he did feel like if she went with him, he might have been able to save her. Because, I mean, you know, obviously... At the start of the episode, at the start of the episode when she says, like, what could monsters possibly be afraid of? And he says, me. You get that very small hint of his sort of, like, overlordiness that Moffat likes to throw into Matt Smith's Doctor, which is, like, I'm the all-powerful. And obviously it wasn't so, like, prominent back in, like, Tennant's first sort of, like, thing. Obviously, we get the evolution of Tennant's Doctor and how, you know, all that happens. But without sort of giving spoilers, most of you probably would have watched this, but, you know, yeah. I like to not sort
we
of...
We want to make sure we can be accommodating people who are watching this for the first time.
So, obviously, you get that kind of, like, very small inkling of, like, oh, I can change things. And despite the fact that he knows that, like, what he's doing is, like, set time frames and stuff, like he mentions, it's kind of like, you know, we can't just go in the TARDIS because we're part of the events and stuff. I think part of him maybe does think maybe I could save her and maybe I could show her the world that she... dreams of since she's met me, and you know, she's known me since I was 7. Maybe I could be this person for her, this like for this lonely angel that she so desperately sort of desires.
Yeah.
But did you find out whether tuberculosis was fatal?
Apparently, according to sort of modern medicine, in like a case of 100,000 people who are HIV negative, the mortality rate is like 2-3%.
So
it's quite low.
Basically, like, curable.
Right. So I wonder whether there is that inherent, like, if she, you know, or maybe he realises that this is it probably would be a fixed point in time. He would have only 5 years with her, but then, you know, like, she could just, depend with how she ages, supposedly, she could have been 50 when he brought her back, and she could have died at the age of 42. Like, in terms of, like, relative time to her timeline, but in reality, that she could have been older.
So if he brings her back to the point when he took her, is that what you mean? So, like, basically, if he were to steal her on that day when she was 37 and he saved her, if he went away with her for, I don't know, 15 years, but then brought her back to that exact day, would she then only have another 5 years? Is that what you mean?
Probably.
Right.
Because whatever, assumedly the events that would lead to her
getting
catching
tuberculosis
would stick. And I think maybe, because obviously the Doctor isn't, he's not in his time Lord Victorious state yet. Mm. We see that at the end of season four. And he won't want to mess with fixed events in time. But one thing that makes it potentially easier is the fact that she's already accepted her potential death once already. Mm-hmm. She's already been told that in 5 years they're going to get you. And then at that point, in another 5 years, it will get you.
Yeah.
But this time, there isn't anything that can save you. There is nothing that can save you. This is something that is going to have to happen mm-hmm. to you. But maybe, you know, being this intelligent, this strong woman, maybe she can go, do you know what?
No.
Fine. If I can have 5 years of incredible intergalactic travel and intergalactic shagging with the Doctor, if I can do that for 5 years and hopefully not die from a Dalek blast or something in the process, then what a 5 years it'll be. I feel like she might be able to accept that. If she can borderline accept that when Rose tells her this and she's still coming to terms with this whole, you know,
new world,
clockwork droid malarkey, then maybe she could come to terms with the idea that just one day disease will get her.
She probably could. I mean, she almost does in the letter, I think, doesn't she?
Exactly, yeah. She acknowledges the fact that she's
growing
getting on
weak.
And she, you know, it's one of those mysteries of humanity's or a person's psyche, this idea that people can sort of gauge when they're about to go, like relatives I know, people I have loved, have just somehow known that it was going to be their time. Not going to go into detail because it's very sad,
but she she does very much sort of take that, like, I think that's almost like the worst part about this whole kind of thing, is like, you could say that their relationship felt a little bit forced at the start and whatever, but, you know, I think maybe one of the reasons that the Doctor falls for her so quickly is the fact that he knows that in her head he has been there her entire life, and he kind of adopts that as, like, I am her, like, her sort of secondary
guardian angel.
Yeah, like, I'm her sort of guardian, I'm there to protect her, like, I promise her this, I promise her that, I saved her from the droids here, there and everywhere, and he kind of falls into that. And so when he's so excited, I think it's so heartbreaking, because, like, that whole sequence from the minute she shows him the fireplace is, like, you know, or even the speech where she goes, like, I would have enjoyed the slow path. It's almost like she kind of knew that, like, she wasn't going to see him again. And she was like, I would have enjoyed the slow path. And then takes her to the fireplace and he disappears. And he's like, oh, pack a bag. And he's so, so excited. And then literally within 30 seconds, she's gone. It's like that devastation of, like, seeing that process. And I think this is where David Tennant's acting is, like, so phenomenal, because he goes from being, like, absolutely elated to literally having to be heartbroken in, like, the next sort of, like, I mean, obviously they wouldn't have filmed them back to back, but, like, you know what I mean? Like, his acting comes through really, really sort of powerfully of, like, you know, he's sort of ecstatic 1 minute and devastated the next, and you just, like, you like, so believable the way he sort of says to Rose, like, I'm always all right, and you just see that look on his face, like, you know he's not, even if you weren't there, like, Rose wasn't, she knows he's not, but, like, there's nothing she can do about it. And you can see when Mickey says, come on, time to show me around, it's like,
he reads it as well, and he's like, you know what, let's just leave you to it.
But, like, the Doctor is almost grateful that he gets that moment to himself, because he looks at them as they walk off and he's like, right, now I can be sad.
Now I can read this, now I can grieve, basically. Like, I'd almost forgotten about the fact that the episode actually ends with the TARDIS dematerializing and showing you the SS Madame de Pompadour, and obviously the implication is that the droids, almost, bless them, they used every single resource they had, which unfortunately ended up being the crew, and the last thing their, like, programming could think of to try and save the ship, what they're destined to do as a being, basically, they went for Madame de Pompadour. But I couldn't remember exactly where the cliffhanger came, or the ending came in, and I thought you could have done it like at the end of series 4, I want to say, after Donna,
when
the last episode, right at the end of the last episode of the series, after the Doctor does to Donna what happens, the episode ends with the Doctor just sitting there looking completely devastated, and that's where it ends. Like, I almost...
Oh, right, instead of revealing the Madame de Pompadour stuff.
Yeah,
right.
It could have just ended with that, and that would have been, as much as it's more like a bittersweet moment of seeing the ship, her legacy, like, lived on as this historical figure, they could have just left it with the Doctor being completely and utterly heartbroken, and just left it at that to really leave the episode, not necessarily on a downer, but just on something that would stick because it is sad.
I don't know. I quite enjoyed the ending because it wraps...
I'm not saying I would change it,
because
I'm just like, that could have still worked.
Yeah, oh yeah, it could have done. But I think the ending of showing you the fact that the ship is called the SS Madame de Pompadour was a very clever thing to do on Moffat's part, because it pieces together kind of all the unknowns throughout the episode of, like... Rose asks, like, well, actually, the question is asked throughout the entire episode. So Renette says, why are you after me, or why do you want me? And he's like, you are compatible, but never explains why. Rose says, yeah, but why her? Twice. And this question is asked, like, throughout the episode, which you never get an answer to. And you sort of almost forget that you... need to know the answer because of everything else going on in the episode. Like, you know, they salvaged the crew to use them for parts, and, you know, you just kind of assume that maybe they just landed on this person, and, you know, obviously there's a reason, but the fact that you're never going to know. And it's a nice way to wrap it up for the audience, but obviously it gives you... I feel like it almost adds to the slight heartbreak for the Doctor, because he never fully understands why they ended up where they ended up and why they were going for her in the first place. Whereas I think if he hadn't parked his TARDIS in front of that painting and he'd seen her painting, it would have just tied everything together for him and sort of been like, do you know what? Her legacy lived on. She was, like, you know, she was a fantastic woman or whatever. But it adds to his heartbreak of him never really understanding why that was a thing and never getting that closure of, like, oh, it's okay, you know, her legacy lives on. Because you see that, like, her painting and the title on the ship, it sort of does that for us. And it's kind of like, oh, that's lovely, but also really sad.
Yeah.
So
there's a lot to love about this episode.
I love this episode.
It's very much a love story between Madame de Pompadour and the Doctor. You know, the flaws are, like, you know... Why? What purpose do Mickey and Rose serve throughout the course of
Apart
this?
Apart from the one fantastic joke right in the middle where the Doctor says something like, go and get Arthur or something like that. And Rose goes...
Oh, he goes, what? Who's Arthur? A good name for a horse. You're not keeping
the
horse.
No, you're not keeping the horse. And he goes, well, I'll let
and
you keep,
like,
Mickey.
You know, the Doctor's like, go away, I'm not your mother. Like, he's like, oh, I don't want this horse. Leave me alone. Oh, God. And he's like, actually, do you know what? I love this horse. I just want the horse. Take the horse. It's mine.
It's like, you're not keeping the horse. Well, I'll let you keep Mickey. That joke just sold the whole thing.
You can tell he's already liking it because, you know, when he finds the horse, he then finds that doorway that goes out into the gardens where he sees Madame de Pompadour chatting to the other woman. Mm-hmm. And it's like, he didn't even let the horse out.
No.
He didn't let the horse go.
It.
Even though he's like, this is where
you
came from.
Out with you.
He just kept it. I love that.
Arthur,
I love that.
Fantastic name for a horse. but yeah, so Mickey and Rose, literally, the only purpose the only purpose they serve in this episode is to be kind of the butt of jokes and to be, like, the rescuees, I guess.
Yeah, they could have easily done this, that they do almost what they did in A Christmas Carol, one of Matt Smith's specials, where
that was a good
episode.
Oh
no, Amy and Rory are trapped on a ship that's going to crash.
Welp.
That's it. They're just like away from it. The events of the episode tie back to that, but that's just how it is. Mm-hmm. They could have probably, I feel like they could have easily done this without Rose there.
But I mean, yeah, no, I love the horse. Anyway. The horse is when he went around the corner, I was like, oh my God, this is the bit where he meets the horse.
Yeah, you can hear the music and it's like, something weird's going to happen here. Oh my God, it's a horse. I love that. I love that. So there's a lot to love about The Girl in the Fireplace. I do hold this episode quite fondly, personally.
It's a really good one.
It's a nice one to just sit and watch. And there's enough there to dig into to really start to feel that emotion that, like, Tennant feels, and to feel the love that Madame de Pompadour feels. But you can also just sit and watch it for the cool clockwork droids, which look really cool. I love the amount of time that went into putting together this big clockwork thing.
And the detail on the masks and stuff, like, you don't really realise how cracked and, like, old they are. Because
yeah, they really play up on it.
Realistically, do the clockwork droids disguise themselves as 18th century, like, aristocrats? Or
I would say they would just be like almost like naked, I guess, during normal flight.
Yeah, and then they just don the costumes again, to fit.
If they're in this position where they need to do whatever they can to keep the ship going, they will, you know, improvise.
I think they killed some people and stole their costumes and used them for parts as well.
Yeah, found some masks, or they managed to craft them out of whatever bits and bobs.
But it kind of like implies that they're super old. And that they've obviously been doing this for a while. And I like that. The fact that that little attention to detail is like their masks aren't perfect and stuff.
Yeah. So yeah, I enjoy that episode. There is one last question, which I think similar to a question we had last week about child actors, that we're going to take sort of ahead, take forward with us, because it's not really something we can answer just yet. Ryder Ho asks, which do you think is the best representation of a historical figure in Doctor Who? And that's a tough question, and B, that's probably one you're going to have to leave with us, because so far we've only had Madame de Pompadour and Charles Dickens.
Damn, there's really so many.
There are lots. We've got Shakespeare, we've got Nikola Tesla, Rosa. Thomas Edison, we've got Van Gogh, we've got Rosa
Parks, God, there's so many good historical figures.
We've got Winston Churchill, we've
Doctor
got
Who.
Adolf Hitler.
Jesus Christ. Yeah.
So I would say, Rai, leave that one with us. That's probably one we'll get back to, because I'm sure
we're
going
to have
to
make a note of it, because I will forget.
Child actors and historical figures. So we'll keep an ear out for those. I will write it down.
Thank you.
So leave that one with us, my friend. Thank you for leaving
Thanks
us the
question. Thanks for such a good question.
Yeah. If you do have any questions regarding next week's episode, which is The Rise of the Cybermen, Cybermen are back. Parallel Earth, etc.
Oh, this is a two-parter, isn't it?
This is a two-parter, so we're going to have to do, as we said at the beginning of this series / at the end of last one, we're going to do two-parters as their own episode from here on out, because it's kind of hard to do, to dig into the first part and then have not feel maybe not as much to talk about and try and stretch things out for the second. So
however, we will
maybe
still analyse them as like two separate parts. So we'll say how it feels to end it at like the point where they ended it and like begin the next
we'll
one.
We'll still
and stuff
discuss
like that,
the cliffhanger, etc. Yeah. Yeah. But that's going to be a two-parter. So Age of Steel, Rise of the Cybermen and the Age of Steel. So if you've got any questions regarding that episode or those episodes, that story, I should say, then let us know in the comments below if you're listening on YouTube, if you are just listening on your whatever podcast app / platform / service you are on, then you can tweet us the questions at WhoCulture. Use the hashtag #EscapingCerberus so we can see it.
Can I interject? A question. I was going
to
say,
you have to tweet it to us at WhoCulture. Use the hashtag #EscapingCerberus.
No.
Amy, come on.
No. So that
you get special treatment. Do you?
Who asked the question about the historical figures?
Ryder.
Okay. Rye. Okay, I'm really sorry for butchering your name. So that they don't feel like we've just brushed over their question and won't come back to it. I'll ask you this instead then. Who did you prefer, Charles Dickens or Madame de Pompadour, since we've watched those two?
Charles Dickens.
Did you?
Not because it's series one and it's Eccleston and everyone always hangs me up for
literally,
liking Eccleston things.
The whole, they love Eccleston, oh, they're in it. No, actually, we love more than Eccleston.
I think I like Charles Dickens more so because he comes around as a character to all the stuff that's going on. Madame de Pompadour just kind of accepts it, and don't get me wrong, she's a badass and I love it, but I much prefer the development of Charles Dickens because he's a denier in the first place, and then it all just sort of clicks for him, and there's so much more. You know, the thing about Madame de Pompadour is she's a very sort of calm and collected character. You see that like fear and emotion a bit later on, but usually she's pretty like, she's like sharp as a tack and she can read the situation. She will command the room she's in. Charles Dickens like sort of flounces about like a bit of an idiot when he's in the funeral home.
Yeah.
And I love that about him and the way that the doctor kind of explains being a fanatic and Charles Dickens being, you know, in this position where he's up against somebody that, you know, celebrities of nowadays will be used to. Back then, that maybe wasn't the case, or at least people wouldn't be able to get this that close to him. So I love that whole thing, and yeah, I prefer Charles Dickens.
Okay.
It's kind of like if you made me pick one, it would be that way around.
I think I personally would go the opposite. I think I'd pick Madame de Pompadour, mainly for the reasons that you listed, in the fact that she's an absolute badass, and the fact that she just like, she doesn't take crap from anybody. She's like, she like you said, she's sharp as a tack. She knows what's going on. But also, I feel like, I don't know, like, yes, Charles Dickens' character did have that kind of evolution and stuff. But I feel like slightly more likely. I don't know whether Madame de Pompadour is slightly more relatable in a way.
Yeah, potentially.
I don't know. I think I just slightly preferred her. I couldn't really give you a reason. I just feel like I preferred her character.
We don't have, like, they're two very different characters, so that it's kind of hard to really,
it's like saying which, like, do you overall prefer,
put
apple or
one
orange
above the other. But yeah, we'll get back to that one, right, when we get through more of these historical figure episodes. I say, we had Queen Victoria as well.
Oh my god, duh, of course.
I've probably missed another
Queen
one
Victoria
as well.
Queen Victoria was fantastic. Pretty fantastic. If we're going to throw Queen Victoria,
there's probably not been many historical figures they've got wrong. We'll get to that.
We need to make a list of all the historical figures that have ever been like thingy did Doctor Who.
That is about all the time we have for Girl in the Fireplace. So again, if you have any questions regarding the rise of the Cybermen and the Age of Steel, then let us know in the comments if you're on YouTube. If you are listening on your podcast app / whatever, then please let us know on Twitter. Please use the hashtag #EscapingCerberus in your tweets, or at least send them to @WhoCulture, because at least then I can find them.
Yeah, we won't see them otherwise.
If you tweet them directly to me, there's a good chance they might get buried with how long it is between, like, doing these podcasts. That's not a flex to say that my notifications are full all the time, but usually if you tweet me something like that, then it might get buried and I'm going to scroll back
if
through
you tweet
to try
me
and find
however
it. Tweet
I'll
Amy is fine
see it.
Where can they find you on Twitter?
They can find me at @Ames_Elizabeth.
You can find me on Twitter @PickupChangeToe. As said, best thing to do, just tweet them @WhoCulture.
Yes.
Use the hashtag #EscapingCerberus if you can
for
as
next
well,
week's
please.
Episode
spelling is in the title.
Watch two episodes.
Watch both parts.
Because otherwise you'll be an episode behind.
Exactly. And it's not very often that we'll be an episode ahead of you, because you guys have already finished season 4, unless I'm mistaken.
Yes,
finished
sorry.
Season 2. And we apologise. But anyway, thank you very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Escaping Cerberus. Hopefully we'll see you soon. Hopefully not too far away.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, take care of yourselves. Be good.
Stay safe.
We'll see you soon. Indeed.
Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like wary of police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.